The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and so much more. We do this podcast for you every single week. We have been doing that for more than 3 years now. If you enjoy listening to the show and are listening to it on Apple or Spotify, please stop by and give us 5 stars, leave us a review, let people know about it, and spread the word that this is the best entertainment podcast. It's the number 4 rated entertainment nude podcast in the Gambia. So that has to count for something in this world. And it does. And this week we have an excellent show for you. We're going to talk about the number 1 show on Netflix. It is a romantic comedy called Nobody Wants This, stars Kristen Bell and Adam Brody as a sex podcaster who falls in love with a LA rabbi. Yes, that's right. That's the premise of the number 1 show on Netflix. I thought the show was kind of sweet, kind of relatable in some ways. Rebecca Kirsten, our frequent contributor, found it very unsweet and unrelatable and really despised it. And she and I have an extremely lively conversation about Nobody Wants This, and that's coming up in a little bit. But first, I'm going to talk to Stephen Garrett about the disastrous sequel to 2019's Joker. This is Joker Folie à Deux, starring Joaquin Phoenix and Lady Gaga. It is a musical that includes a cartoon about the Joker, the Batman villain, and it is dreadful in ways that I find it almost difficult to describe, and Stephen and I will break down Joker Folie à Deux after this interlude.
Arthur, do you remember any of what happened?
Arthur Fleck is a monster.
You should see it out there. They're all going crazy for you. We did this.
Stephen Garrett, did you or did you not write a review in Book and Film Globe this week of Joker, Folie à Deux?
I cannot claim responsibility.
Answer the question, Stephen. Look, answer the question.
I can't control my split personality. I don't know what happened. All I knew is how I wanted to kill myself after seeing this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. We both made the choice to live, but it wasn't an easy choice after seeing Joker, Folie à Deux in the cinema this weekend. I'm pretty fresh off of it. I just got out of my screening about an hour ago.
Ooh la la.
As I'm talking to you, Stephen, and man, this is a really bad movie in ways that like movies just don't dare to be anymore.
You know what? I thought it was kind of daring in certain ways that I don't know whether it intended or not, but it certainly didn't follow through with the kind of interesting ideas it was kind of putting out there, you know? I'm all for like, let's rethink what a musical is or what a prison movie is or what a courtroom drama is. And there's a lot of material here where you could really kind of twist it in a fun way. And it was not.
The problem is the prison movie elements were cliched.
Yep.
The musical elements mostly fell flat. There were a few good visuals, you know, when they're sort of during the fantasy sequences, when they were pretending to be on The Tonight Show or wherever.
Yeah.
And the courtroom drama was especially bad, I thought. He was especially limp and really cliched. I've seen better courtroom dramas on CBS on Thursday nights.
Oh,
that's true.
But you know what, though? I mean, I like the idea of like, okay, he's going to mount a defense for something that's indefensible. He's his own lawyer, but he's not a lawyer. So that makes room for like a real subversion of what it is to have a courtroom drama. You know, and the same for the romance. Like these two people are insane. So sure, you don't need to develop that. You could just say, hey, they're both insane. So yes, they think they're both in love with each other or you know, they're obsessed with each other, but they don't even really explore that or sell it in any convincing or interesting way.
Well, also like Harley Quinn or Lee Quinzel or whatever her name is,
in this movie, played by Lady Gaga. You know, there's, for someone who's a convicted murderer or an accused murderer who's going to be convicted, the Joker sure does get a lot of leeway in terms of who can visit him.
I know. Well, there's
when,
that too.
And when. I mean, and he gets a lot, he seems to have a lot of freedom to just kind of roam around, to do whatever he wants in the prison. You feel like they would lock him up like Hannibal Lecter, especially considering at the end of the first movie, you know, he murdered a psychiatrist and was running around covered in blood, and you know, and yet there here he is, just kind of in a bad version of the Shawshank Redemption, lorded over by Brendan Gleeson, who can't stop singing "When the Saints Go Marching In." Well, okay, but let's not bury the lead. This is a musical Joker movie.
There certainly is a lot of music in it.
There's a lot of, it's a musical. I mean, Joaquin Phoenix and Lady Gaga break out into song every 10 minutes. There's a song where they're dancing and singing around badly. Badly.
Not her. She sings well. She sings well, and she even dances pretty well.
Yeah, that's Lady Gaga. I mean, she's a musical star. She's a musical star, you know? But Joaquin Phoenix cannot sing.
No.
At all.
And you know what? Again, like, let's explore that. Of course he can't sing. Of course he can't mount a defense for himself. Of course he can't, like, you know, he's a mentally ill person. So let's, like, what would that mean then? And I don't feel like they explored what that means in any of these scenarios. They just said, oh, he's dressed up as Joker. Let's have him dance around in a funny way, you know, and they're doing the best with very thin material.
All right. Look, I like Batman. You know, we talked about the Penguin series last week. Scott Gold and I talked about the Penguin series. And that is a show that, you know, alters the Batman mythos a little bit and subverts it, but still kind of respects the stories that we've all grown to know and love. And I don't know how closely you followed the, you know, since they introduced Harley Quinn in the DC comic books and the Batman the Animated Series 30 years ago, she's become an integral part of pop culture and played, you know, with a lot of energy and wit and sex appeal by Margot Robbie in the Suicide Squad movies.
Yeah.
And here she's just like kind of a mentally ill Lady Gaga who likes to like put, you know, triangle shaped mascara on.
Right, right. And again, like the potential there, I want to believe that Todd Phillips is trying to be so subversive about these ideas. Like, oh, you want a supervillain? I'm going to give you this mentally ill, very damaged person who does a lot of damage because he's so mentally ill. But there's nothing super villainous about him. And the same with Harley Quinn. Like, she's not some genius mole, you know, who's just as psychotic as he is. Like, what would it be like if she's just an average fangirl who adores the idea of what Joker is, but then realizes that he's really not what she's imagining, you know? There's so much potential in this, and I just feel like it just fell short in a really disappointing way. But I want to give him credit for, I mean, it's just such a great
idea. You want to give him credit.
I want to see Gaga. How excited were you when you heard that Lady Gaga was going to be Harley Quinn? Because it's a great idea.
I'm not a huge Lady Gaga fan. I wasn't that excited, but I do agree that it was a good piece of casting. Here's the thing. You say you want to give Todd Phillips credit, Stephen, but
And I give him a bit of credit in the review. Yeah.
But I think people give Todd Phillips too much credit. I feel like this is a director who has caught lightning in a bottle twice with the original Hangover movie and then with with Joker, which kind of established it, you know, the Hangover movie established him as like a maker of bro comedies that can make a lot of money. And then he proceeded to torch that reputation with the lousy sequels to the Hangover. And Joker, I think, almost accidentally established him as some kind of auteur who can make artsy Batman films, but he's not Christopher Nolan. He's not Christopher Nolan. He does not have, he does not really have the chops. And this movie, you know, is visually is not that interesting. The story is a mess. The musical sequences are poorly staged. The whole thing, I was sick of Joaquin Phoenix's moaning, twitchy face by the end of it. Whereas the first Joker, I thought it worked really, really well.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, what is the intent here? And the first Joker, I thought was a mess. But did have this kind of dark energy about it that was a little bit sharper, maybe more than a little bit sharper, because it really was this manifestation of rage. And the idea that one person's isolated, manic, inward-looking rage taps a vein that then other people in the world identify with, are inspired by, and, you know, foment.
It was an artsy fartsy take on the origin story of the Joker, right?
Right. Exactly.
Whereas this movie pulls the rug out from under what we thought it was. And they're like, no, he's just crazy. And also, you're a sucker and you're crazy too.
I don't want to believe that it was that cynical. I mean, if the first movie was about rage, pointed rage, and just kind of unleashing that kind of dark energy, this one feels very much like, you know, the kind of that sad incel desire for love.
Okay.
And fine. Connection. Whatever. And I think that's what they were trying to do, but it just gets fuzzy by the end. It ends in a kind of tragic way that feels very obvious. I don't think we'll be seeing this Joker again.
I don't know. Right? No, it seems highly, highly unlikely. I don't mind the theme. The themes are one thing. You know, to me, I don't go to see a movie for themes. I go to see a story that makes sense in whatever context it's presented. It doesn't have to be completely linear. It doesn't have to be obvious, but it does have to have some sort of thematic consistency. And this movie just doesn't have, there's just nothing to hold on to. You know, characters just kind of appear and disappear. Again, like I said, like Harley Quinn just shows up whenever and goes away whenever.
She does. And it was also one of those, like, is how many of these are fantasy sequences? How much is he imagining? Because, you know, again, he had that love story with Zazie Beetz. And there is a through line there because they both mimic the, you know, pointing their gun at their temple and blowing their brains out. So I was kind of wanting to give it slack because it made me feel like, is Gaga even real? I mean, is her character? She is to a point, but also maybe there's some scenes there that are very clearly fantasy sequences and others, which I kind of wonder, maybe those are, but they just aren't made clear to be, which also is to the film's detriment. It should be a little clearer about what it's trying to say.
Well, and again, with the musical numbers, sometimes they're fantasy sequences. Sometimes Joker just breaks out into song in the jail or in the courthouse. And then sometimes we go 20 or 30 minutes where it's just him getting the shit beaten out of him by prison guards and we don't see any music.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And also, like, the supporting characters. I mean, you know, we have Brendan Gleeson and Catherine Keener, who are two quality actors, to say the least, but they're given parts that are so cliched and so dull, that you just kind of sit there wondering, why do they even exist in this story? What purpose do they serve? And, you know, if you look, I don't know if you've watched The Penguin yet on Max, but you look at the first 2 hours of that show, which I have looked at, and which runtime is shorter than Joker, and there's so much more that happens in those 2 hours, and the character building and the acting and the humor, it's so much sharper, and, you know, and still manages to be a bit subversive.
Yeah, I mean, I think pulling the rug out is definitely an apt way of describing this movie. And again, I want to believe that it's intentional to a point, but it's just not executed as well as it needs to be.
You know what I want to see after this movie? I want to see a movie where the Joker looks like the Joker from 1950s Batman comics and drives a purple car with his face around on it.
You want to see Cesar Romero? You should just watch the 60s show. That was a very subversive Batman. I mean, Joker.
in its own way.
When he goes surfing, you remember he goes surfing with Batman? That was pretty subversive.
In the movie. That's what I want. I don't want dark Joker who, like, cuts people up. I want, like, he has to be sinister. You have to get the sense that he's going to blow up the carnival or whatever. But, I mean, come on. This movie he's not even sinister. He's not a crime boss.
But that's the point. That's the point he's trying to make, which he did in the first film. He's not a crime boss. You know, it's like he gets his acolytes and he runs from them. You know, it's like he's in over his head. He didn't ask for this, you know, which I thought was kind of an intriguing idea. And you get a sense of it in this film, too.
Yeah, I will say the last 10 minutes are pretty good.
Yeah.
But that's it.
Is it because it's the last 10 minutes and you're like, I can finally go home now? Because this also is much longer than it needs to be. This is a good 20 minutes longer than the last movie, which is not fair. This should be tight.
Well, I thought the last 10 to 15 minutes of the last movie were the best part, too.
Yeah.
But what led up to it was better than what led up to the last 10 decent 10 minutes of this movie.
It's a bit more clarity in the other movie. And, you know, again, with musical numbers, I think this is the trick with musicals is that you know, for it to really work, the musical numbers need to advance the story, right? Like the song needs to have a point.
Well, the music kind of sucked too.
And this is just jukebox. This is just like, I'm going to break into a love song because I'm in love with you and here's a love song.
I wanted to like literally suffocate myself in my bowl of popcorn when they started singing that Carpenter song. In the visitation room, I'm like, no.
So you know what I like though is the courtroom song when they were singing that song, The Joker, which is a great song and very obvious, but they done well. That was fun.
That was probably the best. Also when they came out with the big electric lights behind them on the sort of the fake Tonight Show set,
yeah,
that was also pretty good. The rest of the music just doesn't work, you know. For instance, I don't think like there's a movie version of Wicked coming out this fall. Somehow, I don't feel like that's going to subvert audience expectations of what a musical should be in the same way.
Much less bloody than this.
Much less bloody, sure. And also like they, you know, there's actually a soundtrack. You know, here it just kind of felt like are these the songs Todd Phillips could get the rights to?
Ooh, he got some. There was some. Solid songs.
Yeah, sure.
Do you know what? You know what this movie is lacking? I think people are going to be disappointed or maybe expecting that it would be, but this movie was not chilling in the way that the other one was. There were a couple, you know, those two scenes where he you know, where Joker actually kills people in the previous movie were absolutely riveting and terrifying.
Yes.
And very chilling. And there's nothing even close to that in this movie.
No.
And maybe that's intentional, or maybe it's just a kind of dearth of ideas about what to do with this love affair, but I kind of wanted the two of them to do some real damage.
Yeah, it would have required a movie with an actual story.
Oh.
Well, this didn't have a story. It did not have a story. It was a dirge. It is a dirge, and it is a huge misfire. I was basically, people in my theater were walking out.
Ouch.
And not because they were grossed out, because they were just offended at how bad it was.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it'll be, it's going to fizzle. It's going to be a flop, though.
It's going to be a huge bust. No Oscar nominations for this sequel. Stephen Garrett, the court finds you guilty of writing a review of Joker Folie à Deux in this week's Book and Film Globe. We sentence you to a lifetime of writing movie reviews for us. I'll talk to you next week.
All right.
Hi, everyone. I'm Joanne.
I'm Noah.
Did you know there's a rabbi here?
No shit.
Yeah.
Where?
He has a beard, and he was definitely judging me.
Sounds like a rabbi. Who's your friend?
There's not a Jewish bone in her body, unless you put one in her.
You're the rabbi?
It's hot, right? I mean, is there a world where this works?
The most popular show on Netflix currently is called Nobody Wants This, and it's a romantic comedy set in the tonier neighborhoods of Los Angeles. It stars Kristen Bell and Adam Brody, and it's about a female sex podcaster, played by Bell, obviously, who falls in love with a rabbi. With a Reformed Jewish rabbi, played by Adam Brody. And the show has proven surprisingly controversial, with people saying that it depicts Jewish women in a negative light, but other people are saying that it depicts Jewish culture in an extremely positive light. People either love it or hate it. I'm somewhere in between. Rebecca Kirsten, who I frequently have on this show to discuss Jewish-related cultural matters, is of the opposite camp. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi.
All right. So, Becky, you said that this is one of your least favorite TV shows of all time.
It is my most hated TV show, I think, of the last couple years. And I remember I watched Man in Full, so that's saying a lot.
I understand how it might not be your cup of tea. I'm interested to hear what your specific arguments against this program are. Do you think it is anti-Jewish? Because I really don't see that.
I don't think it was anti-anything. The problem was it's incredibly shallow.
Yes.
Every single character was horribly written and incredibly shallow. So I wasn't sure if I should be rooting for their relationship or rooting for both of them to seek therapy. Joanne's a horrible person. Her sister's horrible. Her parents are horrible. Noah is a complete malcontent. His character is not even a character. It's just a basic, he's a cute Jewish guy, but his why, for example, we've had 10 episodes. Why did he want to become a rabbi? What's his connection? What's his feeling to being a person who spreads joy and spreads God to other people? Joanne has nothing in her life worth really living for. She's, it's hard to tell what her age is because she's been Botoxed into a wrinkle-free affect. How old is she? She's never been to college. She has this absolutely dismal podcast that I can't imagine anyone listening to. But her attraction to Noah does seem real. But my main complaint about this is that I understand it's written by somebody who converted to Judaism. She seems to have really no understanding of Judaism whatsoever. And I'll give you a few examples. In 10 episodes, did they ever say the word Israel?
Right. Well, here's the thing. It is a, this is a Reform Jewish show, right? I mean.
Oh, this is a Hollywood Jewish show.
Well, here's the thing. You've never lived in Los Angeles. I know you're an East Coast Jew, and I lived in Los Angeles for a number of years. And let me tell you, this thing reflects the lives of LA Jews fairly well, I think. I really do, you know, and I think these are very LA people. And this is, in a lot of ways, is a very, you know, relatable story if you are a person of a certain age and of a certain social class. The people in the middle to upper middle class, LA people who I know, and I know a lot of them, love this show because, you know, they meet cute and they walk around Los Feliz eating ice cream and they go to their special restaurants and they, you know, they go to the Schwitz and they have their special thing, you know, and it's all in that setting where everyone of that, every type of person has that. Have their little special relationships and their dalliances. And I will say this as well. Like, I understand the show is very shallow. And I think their podcast that Kristen Bell and her sister, played by Justine Loop of Succession, who's Willa in Succession, is ridiculous. And the idea that this podcast where they discuss dildos, dildos and dildos, the idea that this would have an audience is absurd. Although it's based on a podcast that Erin Foster had with her sister, and they was obviously quite successful because she got a sitcom deal out of it. So all I'm saying is that this show in some ways reflects that reality, and it also does, to my mind, have warm feelings toward Jews and toward Jewish men, even if it is, you know, pretty shallow. Like you and I talked about Between the Temples, on a previous episode. That also is a show that really had a lot of warmth and respect for Jews and was also, I think, a little more realistic about the lives of regular Jewish people and was had a little more, you know, sort of spiritual depth to it. It was also kind of twitchy and weird and didn't have a popular touch in a way that this show. This show has a popular touch, I think, in the way that Friends did or that Emily in Paris does. You know, it's dumb, it's superficial, but the people are good looking and they smooch.
All I can say is that the writer must have some real antipathy towards her husband's family, because the scene where the mother, the putative mother-in-law, Bina, who's played by the, you know, the great Tova Felcha, to have her eating prosciutto out of a garbage can, I thought there's, yeah. I'm like, you know, I'm insulted in so many ways. I don't even know where to start. That's revolting. It's disgusting. It's like a horrible, it's just a disgusting look for this show that it's mocking her, her real fear and anxiety for her son, that her son brings home a woman like Joanne is a problem. I'd have a problem with that. I think most parents would have a problem with Joanne.
Not because she's not Jewish.
No, because she's uneducated, because she's pretty stupid, that there's just so many little stupid moments in the show that she asks, for example, to know what does shalom mean, or that she does the sign of a cross in a shul. Little moments like that, I guess, are supposed to be funny, but it points to the fact that she's stupid. She's a moron. The fact that she also comes there with an completely unkosher food, doesn't know what prosciutto is, and then waxes on about her podcast, which is about an offensive topic. I don't think there's many parents who would find her to be an attractive mate for their son.
Well, you know, I married non-Jewish, as you know, but my wife.
But did your wife have your mother eating out of a trash can?
No.
Was that part of the setup?
No, my wife is very intelligent and sensitive and lovely but believe me, my family was not thrilled that I was looking to marry outside of the faith, but it didn't take long, and there wasn't that kind of tension. I don't know. Like, I feel like
you're also not a rabbi.
And I am far from a rabbi.
Yes.
Far from a rabbi.
You're not a rabbi.
I'm not even close to being a rabbi. Some would say that I do offer certain teachings on this podcast.
Perhaps not on Maimonides, but
No, not on traditional rabbinical topics. I'm more talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe and issues related to censorship. It's a specialty kind of rabbi. I'm not an ordained rabbi. Let's just say that. Okay, well, but here's the thing. Like, I feel like the show actually kind of likes Jewish men. Like,
as long as they're pussies.
Well, I don't think Noah is, as you put it, a pussy. You know, he is a
His brother is.
His brother is a dope, but at the same time. You know, he's funny and nice and the father is kind of a mensch.
They're all three of them are pushed around by the women in their lives.
I don't know. I feel like the show likes Jewish men and shows some affection for Judaism. I don't see that. I don't see it quite in the same way that you do. I agree that, I find the podcast conceit extremely irritating.
Yeah.
As someone who,
about it on a podcast.
Yeah, a podcast of great integrity and worth that will never, probably never quite reach the heights of Call Her Daddy or whatever. But I don't see it. Also, like, I have to admit, like, I like Adam Brody, he's kind of he's a model in some ways. Is he an agent of Mossad? No. Is he Moshe Dayan? No, he's not like a tough Jew. But for Jews of a certain age, he's just sort of a model of like a sensitive, smart, snarky Jewish guy. And I enjoyed him on the OC, and it's kind of nice to see him recast in that sort of sensitive romantic hero role. He's kind of spent years wandering in the indie film character wilderness. And I also like Justine Loop, who plays the sister. Her character is annoying, but I found the actor extremely appealing.
Yeah.
There's that. Timothy, you can say Timothy Simons, who plays the brother, is a pussy. But he's funny, and he was funny on Veep. So it's not, Kristen Bell, I will admit, like, her character is terrifyingly bad.
Terrible. I don't even know what to say. I've loved her in so many different things. And in this one, I was sick for her and furious too at sort of what was done to her sort of cheerful, lovely, irreverent spirit. Here she's stupid, mean, very unlikable. And very, very difficult for me to reconcile this as someone who any rabbi would be attracted to, let alone someone like Noah.
To what then would you attest this show's rather large popularity and critical reception? Do you think people are just starved for something that doesn't say kill the Jews? Do you think people just like dumb romantic comedies?
I think the opposite is that this is a very Hollywood and LA perspective on Judaism. It's a Judaism that they can accept because it doesn't in any way mention Israel, October 7th, terrorism, violence, the Holocaust. All of those things are washed away, and all you have left is these adorable little traditions and that a bat mitzvah and challah that a bat mitzvah is reduced to, of all things, a dress choice and a theme is a hideous mockery of a tradition that's thousands of years old. There's one character in it I like, a female rabbi saying what a joy it was that she was in the last 50 years, accepted and allowed to be a rabbi. Well, girls also got the right to have a bat mitzvah in the last few decades. And for them to not treat this as an incredible, marvelous opportunity for this cute little actress, instead they have her inexplicably. Where did she get this giant pair of shears at a shul? But she's cutting up her dress in a bathroom, and this is what her bat mitzvah comes down to. It's, to me, it was like a moment of utter insanity. I guess this makes sense in the universe of rom-com, but it's to me a Judaism that's completely devoid of any meaning whatsoever. It's really just about surface appearances.
To me, Becky, it is a very, in some ways, accurate depiction of a certain kind of LA Judaism. And, you know, and I mean, I lived through it. I saw it. And, you know, it's sort of celebrity religion. And there is like a lot of LA Judaism is very sort of activist and progressive. And then there are lots of, you know, they're conservative Jews and Lubavitchers walking around, you know, Melrose Avenue on a late Friday afternoon getting ready for Shabbat. So there is more texture to Los Angeles Judaism than the one depicted in the show. But I feel like I think it's a reflection of the show creator's experience, as opposed to, you know, trying to be like a show that comprehensively treats what it means to be a Jew and a Jewish convert. I feel like, you know, that this is who got the show made. You know what I'm saying?
They had 10 episodes to do something with it, and there was nothing. Mm. Each episode was, the first one I watched it, I'm like, all right. And each episode became almost like a, oh God, like a, just an endurance test to get through it.
I liked how they went to the summer camp for the weekend, which nobody, you know, and up in Ojai or whatever. And the rabbi.
How far is it from L.A.?
It's like an hour and a half. It's doable.
Because they both of them just desert. Like he abandons his Torah study to show up. And this, I loved this moment where he blesses unkosher wine without wearing a kippah. Yeah. I'm like, are you kidding?
Look, it's Reform it's Reform Judaism, Becky. But my favorite bit was like he has this cabin at this retreat that looked like something out of from the Amman Gani Resort. It was like this yes. It's this luxury cabin like this with those. It's like a suite, you know. Yes. And they
didn't even have bunk beds.
Bunk beds. It looked like it had like a million thread count sheets. And
yeah, it was total cottage core. And I'm thinking, have you actually ever seen a Jewish camp?
Right. Yeah, you're lucky if the mattress is intact.
There's a lot more beds in there, and there's going to be towels hanging from the rafters. And
just, yeah. The rabbi's like the assistant rabbi doesn't get to have his shiksa in for a night.
No.
I mean, yeah, she can stay there, but she has to sleep underneath Rabbi Shira in the bunk bed.
There was a few other moments that struck me as super weird and inappropriate. Joanne has a very odd and over-sexualized conversation with the campers who are there, who I think they were preteens. And then
maybe they were 14.
It was a weird conversation for an adult to have with teenagers. Yeah. And then his brother, Noah's brother, makes a fake account on Snapchat to have a weird hookup conversation with a 12-year-old boy. Both of those moments, I thought, geez, most people in the real world would actually be fired for those kind of
right. And the wife and his wife was totally cool with it.
Yeah, I in both cases, my skin was crawling.
Look, obviously, my favorite depiction of all time of Los Angeles Judaism is Curb Your Enthusiasm. You know, which I think, like, you know, shows it's the same world, but shown through a much more cynical and accurate lens.
Yes.
You can't really argue with Larry David's Jewish Los Angeles. The woman, Aaron Foster, who created Nobody Wants This, is no Larry David. But there's something. So you really think that the appeal of the show is that it presents Jews that are safe to sort of be around and make fun of?
Yes, Jews that have been completely removed from an actual Jewish context.
Yeah, well, that sounds kind of familiar these days, doesn't it?
On October 7th, yes.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, this is not a show about October 7th.
No.
It's not a show about the Holocaust. It's a show about a sex podcaster dating a cute rabbi. Your mileage may vary. Rebecca Kirsten's mileage did not get her very far. I thought it was a little cuter than that. But you've given me some food, some challah for thought, Becky. Yeah, I promise I won't have shrimp for dinner. All right. I will not. I have gout anyway. I can't be eating the shrimp. All right, Becky Kirsten, thank you so much. Nobody Wants This is on Netflix. All right, thank you so much. Becky Kirsten, Rebecca Kirsten, is a frequent Book and Film Globe contributor. She did not have anything kind to say about Nobody Wants This, which is on Netflix. I have a few semi-kind things to say about it. Mostly I just like looking at pretty people doing pretty people things, but the show does have its issues. And as someone who does a podcast for a semi-living, I can tell you that its depiction of podcasting is not accurate. And those women need soundproofing. They need some soundproofing in that living room, or else the podcast sound quality is going to be terrible. My producers can tell you all about that. And also thanks so much to Stephen Garrett for talking to me about Joker Folie à Deux. I have never been happier to see a movie flop at the box office as I am this one. What a disaster. What an insult. What a despicable film this is. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We'll be back next week with hopefully some more positive things to say about pop culture, but if we're not, that'll be entertaining too. I will talk at you then.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's the Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.